Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also happy to have back on here on the program once again Scott Spies. He is a home inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service, and he is on the program with us every month. It's always a Monday. We start off the week that week with the show, and this is your opportunity to call in here, ask questions about home maintenance issues. Maybe you're thinking about heating. Time of the year for that, and insulation, time of the year for that. But maybe also people have questions about basements, attics, gutters, roofing, windows, siding. You get the idea. 333-9455. That's the number for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And you may also send your question by email, will-talk@illinois.edu at any point. We'll be happy to take your questions. Say thanks very much.
Well, thank you, David. I'm always glad to come on the show.
We already have somebody ready to go. We will not make them wait. We'll go right there. And the caller is in Urbana, and it's line one.
Well, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about replacing a retaining wall, and I'll try to describe it for you over the phone. We have a Prairie Four Square built in the early 20s. It faces south, and from the west to the east side of the property, there's actually a 2-plus-foot drop in the land. So along the west, along the east side of the house, where the driveway is, there's a retaining wall that's poured concrete, which has begun to heave. It's badly cracked, but it's begun to heave, and this retaining wall goes from zero level at the sidewalk up roughly 2 feet height.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to replace it. Now, it comes within about a foot of the house itself, less than a foot, really. But that portion of the house it goes alongside of is actually the porch, which is its own foundation. You know, it's added on. It was originally an outdoor porch, and it doesn't sit on the house foundation. Rather, it sits on roughly four or five brick pillars that are sort of a foot and a half, but well, not quite a foot and a half by foot and a half square. Now, our question is, if we tear down the concrete wall, if we want to do and replace it with a stepping limestone wall, if we get really close to the base of those brick pillars, is there going to be any risk to the foundation as we're removing the soil there?
There shouldn't be. The pillars themselves are set on a separate footing. The footing should be underneath the brick, generally a concrete footing. And since you're just getting alongside of them, you're not actually affecting the soil that they're actually sitting on, or what's actually holding them up.
Even though we were that close to the foundation itself.
Yeah, getting close to them doesn't bother me. It'd only be if you were cutting underneath them or someplace where we could erode or loosen some of the soil under the pier. Since your piers are actually pushing down onto the soil, they're not moving laterally.
Okay. Well, you've gotten us started on a big project. Thank you.
All right. And there's a couple different ways of putting in retaining walls for things like that, but you do have to either tear them or anchor them, or they do tend to move.
Yeah. We've had success on the other side of the house putting one in, lightly mortaring it in and all, and it's held just fine for 15 or so years. So
now, I don't know how you're planning on cutting it out and removing the old one. If you get great big equipment, such as backhoes and things like that, you want to keep those away from your foundation footing because they can actually compact the soil and move soil around. But if you're hand digging it or you've got a small garden tractor type backhoe, then those will work well.
Oh, okay. Very good.
All right. Well, thank you. Let's go on here. Next, we have someone in Champaign. This is line two. Hello.
Hello. Yes, I have two questions. I'll try to be quick. First one's a little bit of a mystery. Last winter, there was a time where we've got a wood-sided house with there's some cinder block foundation exposed about, say, 9 inches above the ground. And during the winter, at one of the times where there was snow cover on the roof for extended period of time, I noticed that icicles were hanging down at the bottom of the siding, as if water were dripping down between the siding and the walls of the house, and then dripping out the bottom of the siding and then freezing there. The strange thing is, above that spot on the house, there's no gutter. At that point, the roof, where the roof comes down, it goes straight across to a garage. So there's like kind of a little covered walkway. And when I went up in the attic and looked at the roof there, and I could not see any moisture. I could not see any dampness anywhere. I couldn't figure out how the water was getting to that point to get down into the wall on the house there, because I couldn't see any moisture between the roof and the wall there. But my main question is, I don't know who to call about this to even look into it, whether to call roofers or siding people. So that's, I guess, my main question is, who do I even call about something like this?
Well, if it becomes a problem or if you notice it, then yes, you want somebody that's going to be able to decipher exactly where the moisture is coming from. And that generally is a home inspector. That's pretty much exactly what they look for, is that type of thing. Yes, you can call a roofer, and if it's a roofing problem, he can find it. But if it's not a roofing problem, he may or may not know what to look for or where to try and find the issue. So rather than call two or three guys, that's the type of thing where you do call a home inspector. Since you're not seeing anything in the attic, I'm curious as to whether or not it might actually be a condensation problem more than a roof leak problem.
Well, I would have thought of that, except there was so much in one little spot, and there was nothing else anywhere else on the house.
Well,
it still could be. It's possible.
Yeah,
and the other interesting thing is near a spigot, an outside spigot, but it was only in the wintertime, and there was no indication of leakage. There's been nothing all summer, so I don't think that's related.
Yeah, that's going to take just a little bit of investigation,
okay.
Which is the type of thing that a home inspector would do.
Okay, I did not even actually consider that. I should have.
Yep, that would be right up what we call a maintenance inspection.
Right, okay, and probably only when it's actually occurring would that be.
That would be the easiest time, yes.
Yeah. Okay. I asked a friend who has history with building trades and stuff, and he came out and looked, and he suggested waiting till it was good weather to actually work on stuff, and it didn't occur to me that by then there would be less evidence to figure it out.
Right. Because if you've got water coming out from behind a siding, usually we got to figure out where the source is. If you don't see it coming down from the top, the chances are it's not coming down from the bottom. We could have a frozen hose bib that's creating a little bit of a leak, or you may just have a high humidity area there and no insulation in that portion of the wall where it gets cold enough, we get a lot of condensation.
Mm-hmm.
Once water freezes, it doesn't move very fast, so it doesn't take a lot of condensation to create some pretty good icicles.
And we've been here for 9 years, and this was the only year I've noticed it. It's possible that it's been there at other times, and I've never noticed it before. Anyway, I do want to ask one other quick question and let you go. There's some spots on the house where there's small cracks in between the cinder blocks where the mortar there, but now they've developed a small hairline or slightly larger cracks opening up, and I was just wondering if that's of actual concern structurally, or would that only be of concern to allow air in for insulation reasons?
99% of the time, that is just a problem with bugs, moisture, air infiltration, loss of heat, things like that. Unless you actually see that there has been some movement of the block where the gap is wider at the top than it is the bottom, or we've got a horizontal or a vertical shift where you can see where the block used to be and it is now moved sideways or moved downward or upward from where it is. They do make some mortar repair that comes in a caulking type tubes. You can go in there. Basically, it's a premix mortar that comes in a caulking tube, so you can go in there and seal those back up to help reduce the chances of getting some bugs, spiders, things like that back inside of their ants, what have you. Is this on a crawl space?
Yes.
Okay, well, I go down in the crawl space and look and see if those cracks really go up and down from the top of the wall to the bottom wall, and if they do, if they've got any difference in any signs of movement, where they're wider at the top or wider at the bottom, or, like I say, either a vertical or horizontal shift, before I'd say they're not anything. But most of the time, that's just normal. When you've got a concrete wall, the soil around here expands and contracts.
Right.
We have some movement, and concrete likes to resist that, but it's quite often we get enough movement where we get a little bit of cracking in the mortar, particularly as the mortar gets older and gets more brittle.
Right.
So generally speaking, unless there's a movement, I don't get concerned about it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in.
I'll go on again to another call here. This is line number 3 in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. Hi, yes. We're planning to convert our bathrooms sink from a single sink to a double sink, and of course it has all the plumbing just for a single sink in the center. My question is about the plumbing. Is that a pretty straightforward conversion, or is there more detail?
No, it should be quite simple because bathroom sinks, generally we set them up for about a 2 gallon per minute flow, and I'm guessing that we have probably an inch and a quarter, maybe an inch and a half drain line, and that should be more than adequate for two sinks of that type of a flow rate. As a matter of fact, some of the newer faucets are, in order to conserve water, down to 1.2 to 1.5 gallon per minute. And so the drain should be fine. You should just have to put a T in it. You can do it either by putting in a single trap and then putting in a T, or you can put in two traps and then tee them together. And then, of course, the water lines are relatively easy to, again, put a split in there. Your half-inch water line should be more than capable of supplying two sinks.
Okay, so you just put a split onto water lines and they'll be good to go.
Yeah, it shouldn't be hard at all.
Is that something you can screw on the top, or do you have to, like, weld those on? Or
Depending on the fitting you've got right now, I'm assuming, since you're in Urbana, it's probably a copper pipe.
Yeah.
The ideal thing to do would be to solder a copper fitting on there and put in two shut-off valves so you can shut the sinks off individually. So if you ever have to do any repair, you don't have to shut the water off to both of them.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Well, this morning we're taking questions on home maintenance. We do this every month. And our guest is Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. So if you have some kind of question dealing with something basic around the house, some problem, something needs to be fixed, you're thinking about making some changes, doing some remodeling, and you need some advice, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And email. Also, you could do that, will-talk@illinois.edu. Okay, so now we're here at the point where I expect probably most people have had their heat on at least a couple times.
Yeah,
it's been cold
it's
enough.
A little on the chilly side. So when we get to this time of year, I like to recommend to people to think about balancing their heating system. You've been running air conditioning all year long, and air conditioning, we want to put as much cold air as we can on the upper level and on the south side of the house. That's where we pick up most of the sun. Hot heat tends to go up there, so you cool that area and let the cool air move through the rest of the house. Heating is pretty much just opposite of that. Your coldest spot in your house is going to be on the lower level on the north side because it doesn't get any sunlight on that side, and heat does tend to rise, so the cold air is going to be on that end. So you may want to walk from room to room. Can you feel a temperature difference? If you do, get some small thermometers or something, some that will all read the same, that you can put in the house and be able to walk from room to room and see which room is the cold room and which room is the warm room. Start dampering down the heat ducts to the warm room until the cold room has come up to the temperature of the other rooms. And by doing this, you will increase the perceived comfort factor of the house. You walk from one room to the other, you don't go from cold to hot and vice versa, therefore you don't tend to bounce the thermostat up and down. Everybody's cool or warm in each individual room. And this is something that may take 5 or 6 days to actually get a good, even balance. So it's not something that a furnace man or a builder would do on a new construction, just because it depends on your individual living habits and how you move around the house and where you're at in different times of the day. But that balancing that heating and cooling system just makes the house a lot more comfortable and makes you a lot happier in the house. And does save you energy, because instead of having one room at, say, 82 degrees and the other room at the other end of the hall being at 72 and you're chilly and have to turn the thermostat up every time you go into it, we manage to even these things out.
Mm-hmm. So now this is certainly something we've talked about before, but in case people aren't really sure, well, how do you do that? What should people be looking for in terms of these controls that direct either more air or, and we are talking about forced air systems here, controls within your ductwork that are either going to allow more air to go to one place or it's going to restrict the amount of air that goes.
That's a very good point. Usually your furnace will have a main trunk system. If you've got a basement, it's usually above the furnace system. If it's in a crawl space, it's usually on either side. Where you can actually control air that's going to the first floor versus air going to a second floor, or air going to one end of the house versus air going to another end of the house. If they don't have the damper or control in each individual or in each main trunk line, then there are oftentimes individual dampers in the ductwork going to each room or to each register. If we don't have them there, then we start working with the vanes on the register actually in the room. Those are more for fine-tuning. What you want to start with is the ones closest to the furnace. Okay, well, if I've got a two-story house right now this time of year, I want to put most of my heat downstairs. So I'll open that one all the way up. And the upstairs probably doesn't need as much warmth, so I can damper it down. Now, you don't necessarily need to damper it down completely unless we just can't balance it any other way. The furnace does work more efficiently if we can get more air through it. But being more efficient and not having it heat all the rooms evenly is counterproductive. So usually what I'll do on a first floor is open it wide open and start there and damper the second floor about halfway down and then start working from there. And if you can get to individual ducts, then you can start working on north and south rooms. Otherwise, we have to start using the registers that are in the floor or registers that are in the ceiling, depending on how your system's installed.
Yeah, okay. It might take people a little time to figure out which ducts go where. That's the first thing that you're going to have to do. So then when you know when they go, then you can figure out what rooms you would like to have at what level. And then probably for most people, they can have a summer setting and a winter setting. And if they mark, once they get figured out, if they mark them, then you don't have to do this every year.
A black magic marker becomes your friend on that one. Because once you've got your dampers controlled where you want, I just usually make a little mark where that is and put an S for summer and a W for winter. And that way the following season you've got a good ballpark of where you're going to want it to reset the system for cooling again.
Yeah. Let's see. Well, we got another caller here. Let me give the phone number again, by the way, 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Scott Spieces here, and we're taking questions on home maintenance, something we do every month on the show, always on a Monday. Here's a caller, someone to talk to in Champaign County, and that's line one. Hello?
Hi. Mm-hmm. I'm going to probably get 8 inches of cellulose in my attic. I have a story and a half, so I'm concerned about the venting. I guess I'll put those chutes down the side. And but I'm also, I have to have access to it for servicing the attic fan and some antennas up there. And so I'm wondering, do I need to make like a, how much weight can you put on that cellulose? I mean, I put some old rugs down and walk on it, or do I have to put up some kind of plank system walkway, or... It's not that big, but...
cellulose does compress if you've walked on it, and so it does help to have some type of board system or some type of walk area that you can use so that you don't end up with a trail running through it. Is this a truss or rafter?
A supported walk system, so like you put up some boards to fasten them on? And so
well, is this a rafter-type attic or a truss-type attic?
Rafter.
Okay. Well, you're putting in 8 inches. If you're a rafter, you probably already have 6 inches of insulation there from the original ceiling joist. You could put another, say, a 2x6 on edge or something. It doesn't take much of a walkway, something you can put on edge that won't really affect the amount of insulation, but just give you something you can walk up and down. If you need to put something on top of that, you could. On trusses, I usually just nail a 2x4 or something and just a runner that I can get alongside of to get from one end to the other. If you really wanted to have a plank system, an actual walkway, then yes, you'd have to build it up a little bit. But generally, a 2x4 width is enough. And oftentimes, you can get by with just putting the 2x4 on top of the existing joist in a perpendicular manner, from
two
one to the
four,
other.
You mean 2x6? I'm 8 inches in...
Okay, well, it depends on how big a walkway how comfortable you feel going up there. Most people go in an attic can walk a 2x4 without any problem. Now on edge, if it's something you're not quite as comfortable with, then you might want to put a little bit wider walkway up there. But generally, for service people, if they've got a 2x4 on edge to walk up and down, that's usually not a problem to get from one end of the attic to the other. If you're going to be actually doing some work, you say servicing on the fan or something, you may want to put a piece of plywood around whatever equipment is up there that you're working on regularly. But it doesn't take a whole lot of much more than a balance beam to get from one end of the attic to the other. It's a general rule. If you wanted to build it up, then it's not that difficult to do. You can put two 2x6s on edge and then put a 2x8 or a small piece of plywood across the top of them. run them parallel to each other, and then put a piece
of
plywood.
I know what I was thinking of, but I just wanted to see if there's anything about the venting part of it, too.
You do want to make sure that we don't block any of the ventilation. The blowing in the cellulose, it's great. Cellulose covers a lot of areas. One of the things we don't want to do is to block the ventilation from the soffit area, get it filled out into the soffit area. So watching your ventilation, air chutes work quite well because you can put them alongside the sheathing and still get the insulation blown up to the sheathing without sacrificing that ventilation. And then you want to make sure that your upper ventilation is available also.
Okay, very good. Let's go over to Mattoon and talk with someone there. Line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Hi.
My wife and I are looking at buying a new home, and one of the homes that we're looking at has hot water baseboard heat. I'm not sure how old it is. I know that there was it replaced the old furnace, so it's got the newer kind of low units that go along the baseboard with the fins. And I know my parents put that in a home that we lived in Danville back in the late 60s. And I'd just like, though, to get your opinion on the hot water baseboard heating.
I like hot water baseboard heating. It has a disadvantage, and that is no ductwork for cooling. So there is no way of adding a central air to that system. You have to put in a separate system for the central air. But
they
the hot water heat is, you know, it's a very comfortable heat. You don't have any air moving. You don't have any draft. Usually the baseboards are put underneath windows, so there's a warm air barrier between you and the cold surfaces in the house, so it's a very comfortable form of heat. Now, it's not a fast-reacting form of heat, so it's not for the type of person that likes to bump the thermostat up and down once or twice a day, because it does take a couple hours for everything to kind of settle in. So it's one of those.
Actually, that would be a benefit, I think.
I think in the long run it probably is.
Pardon?
I think in the long run, you're correct. If you were to put the thermostat at a certain setting and not change it drastically, it seems to work better. Moving it up and down doesn't necessarily do anything except make the house uncomfortable at times and works the system a lot harder.
Okay, so, and when it comes to placing furniture, what kind of distance do you need to maintain between the units and your furniture?
You need to leave an airflow. What the baseboard heat does is work on a convection. It runs warm water through the baseboard. It heats the air up next to it. That air moves up, and the cooler air comes in past it. So the more air we have moving around it, the more heat it can dissipate into the room. You want to try and keep curtains away from it. You don't want to lay blankets over the top of it. All that reduces the efficiency.
Right.
You know, if you've got a sofa in that particular area, you might want to get one of those little tables, go behind it for a part of the sofa to keep it out 6 or 8 inches. Something like that. So it does need to have some airflow for behind it or around it to actually work efficiently. But it doesn't get hot enough to be an issue. The water running through it, as a general rule, is somewhere in the 130 to 140 degree range. Some of them get up to about 150, and that's about it, which can dry things out, but is generally not a fire hazard.
All righty. Sounds great. Thank you very much. I appreciate your input.
All right. Very good. We'll continue. Next caller is in Champaign, and this is line 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question. We have 2 bathrooms, and whenever we run the shower, we get a lot of moisture buildup in the bathroom, and I was interested in what it would take to do some sort of exhaust fan system in those bathrooms.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell me about that?
Well, it depends on what's above that, how easy the access is in the ceiling or a wall. There are several different types of bathroom fans, different sizes, how many CFM of air they actually move as to how big the bathroom is. If you've got a relatively small cramped bathroom, you can get by with one that is designed for a smaller room that moves, say, 2 cubic feet of air per minute or something like that. Whereas if you've got a room that's 10 feet wide and 20 feet long for a bathroom, and some of these new houses, that's not unreasonable, then you're going to need at least one, if not 2, of the larger units. Fans are also rated for noise in sones, and the fewer sones, S-O-N-E-S, the quieter the fan is. So if you buy one, that's usually the inexpensive ones will be rated at, say, 3, maybe even 4 sones, and that's going to be pretty noisy and annoying. I did notice the other day I saw one that was 0.8, and so that was going to be pretty much invisible. You turn a fan on, you barely know that it's running. So you want to rate it by how big the room is and how much noise you're willing to put up with. You don't want to vent it directly against one of the roof framing members or against any area that's going to collect that moisture. So ideally it should go to the outside unless your attic has really good ventilation. Now, in your particular case, since obviously you brought this up, is this a one-story house or a two-story house?
It's a two-story house with one bathroom on each story. The upper story vents to the attic, but it's a flat roof. There's probably pretty decent ventilation, but you're saying I don't want to blow it just up against the roof?
Well, yeah, don't blow it against something. If it's got good ventilation, you can blow it out into the attic, just kind of blow it out into an open area, and
yeah,
you should be in good condition.
Okay.
If you blow it against some of the roof sheathing, the roof sheathing, of course, getting quite cold, and you start blowing warm, humid air against it, we're going to get condensation on the sheathing.
Sure.
But if you've got good ventilation in the attic, usually you can get by with, since a bathroom fan, even if you've only got, you know, four people or so in the house, it doesn't run more than an hour, hour and a half total for the day.
Right.
It's not like it's putting just tons of water. It's not squirting water up there like a garden hose. It's just putting some extra humidity in there. And as long as the ventilation is working properly, it should take that out. Ideally, I like to run them outside. If you've got an area where you can do that without running too long a duct, so we don't end up reducing the efficiency of the fan. Your first floor may be a little trickier to get to.
Right.
Oftentimes there's a closet you can get to, or some. If you've got an outside wall, they do make wall mount units that you can put it on the wall in the first floor. If it's on
okay.
an outside wall, if it's an interior wall, yeah, it's again a little more difficult to get to. Now, do you have a basement?
No, it's a crawl space.
Okay. On the first floor, there's nothing to say you can't mount one on the wall and run a duct down into the crawl space and vent it out through the crawl space.
Oh, okay. Sure.
Rather than try and destroy interior walls, you know, for two floors, trying to find where to run the ductwork.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, and then you just kind of do it like you do a dryer vent on the outside once you get it to
yeah.
the outside?
Correct. Yeah, and okay. they make, yeah, you want to make sure you get one that has a screen over the top of it to keep the birds from trying to nest in there, because they
sure.
really like the fact that there's warm air coming out of that,
right,
so they like
course.
To try and nest in that area.
Okay. All right, thank
and,
you very much.
Well, I'd like to offer one more hint, and that would be
sure.
to when you install the fan, instead of putting it on a light switch, put it on a timer.
Yes.
That way
idea.
You can turn it on for, say, 30 minutes and take your shower and then go out of the room and the fan runs for 30 minutes and turns itself off, so you don't have to remember to come back and turn it off, but you don't turn it off immediately as soon as you leave the bathroom.
Right.
Let it run long enough to actually pull some of the humidity out.
Okay. All right. Thanks again.
All right. Thank
All
you
right,
for
very
calling
good.
In.
Thank you. Well, we have several people here we'll get to in just a moment. We're going to take a short break in our conversation here with Scott Spies. This is Focus.
AM 580 thanks Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors for its support of Focus. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors offers pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors is pleased to support public radio in Central Illinois on behalf of its customers and business associates.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. We're here weekday mornings, and we have 10 different topics every week. In the second hour today, we'll be offering you an opportunity to talk about computer security. Now, we do a show here every month to talk about computer issues, and this time around, we just want to concentrate on this one thing, on cybersecurity and how you can make your computer and your data more secure. This is October, and it just so happens that October is National Cybersecurity Awareness Month. So we'll celebrate as we talk with Brian Mertz. He's an outreach specialist with SITES, Campus Information Technology and Educational Services at the U of I. And tomorrow morning, we'll talk in the 10 o'clock hour with Nicholas Christakis. He's professor of medical sociology at the Harvard Med School. We'll talk about human social networks in real and evolutionary time. You can check up on the schedule, find out what we'll do for the rest of the week, listen to past programs by going to the website. It's WILL.illinois.edu. In this hour, we're doing home maintenance. We do this every month on a Monday. Scott Spies is here. He's a home inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service. And if you have a question, call us, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You can also email will-talk@illinois.edu. Back to the phones here, and our next person is in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have a house that's only about 10 years old, and it's got windows, double pane windows, of course, that are not, I think, maybe the top quality. It's got a lot of woodwork around it, but once it starts getting colder, there is a lot of condensation on the bottom of the windows. Now, I wouldn't say the house is particularly humid. So, I mean, it's got to have some comfort level of humidity in the winter. But anyhow, the condensation actually, once it gets a bit below freezing, starts freezing at the bottom of the window, of the windows. I was wondering, I guess rather than changing all the windows, which could be quite an expense, I was wondering if there is any sort of product that can sort of absorb, maybe that I can put on the windows in the winter, that would get rid of some of the moisture, like sponge it up, maybe absorbents that I need to replace. And another question is, if I put the plastic seal, you know, like the plastic wrap on the windows for the winter, given the fact that my windows apparently allow enough or don't insulate enough that there is freezing of that condensation right now, would that be problematic? Or if I put it when there isn't too much moisture trapped on the windows, it should prevent that problem from recurring. So I'm going to listen now.
Okay. Well, an extra layer of either window or plexiglass or even one of the shrink wrap plastics will reduce the heat loss past the window because it will increase the amount of air space between the window and the warm area. I'm going to disagree with your assessment that you don't have too much moisture in the house. A double pane window has no moisture source. There is nothing there producing moisture. The only water that's going to condense on that window is the water that's already in the house. So what we really need to do is find out where the humidity level is in the house. And if you've got condensation on a double hung window, it's not the window's fault. It's a high humidity in the house. So you're looking in the wrong place. Rather than try and fix it at the window, we need to figure out where the moisture source is in the house and control that.
Well, I probably have about 45% humidity. And it still condenses. And it doesn't do it on all the windows.
45% in the wintertime is huge. There's no way you should need that much. The house should probably be closer to 20 or 25%. When you've got 45%, you're not going to, you know, when you've got that condensation on the windows, you probably also have condensation in the attic areas and inside walls and things like that, because there's other areas in the house that don't insulate as well. The windows you can see, but if you were to open the attic access and look in the roof, you'll probably find that there's frost on all the roof sheathing. That's just way too much moisture in the wintertime for the temperatures that we get around here. So, yeah, I'm thinking that rather than worry about mopping it off the windows, because, yes, we see it on the windows, but that's not necessarily where it's causing a problem. That will usually delaminate the finish on the windows and can, over time, rot the windows. But it's the moisture in the areas you're not looking at, inside the walls or a place where there's less insulation on the back of the roof sheathing, things like that. So I really feel that in your particular case, you've got too much humidity in the house that we really need to control rather than worry about the windows. The windows, yes, we can put another layer of storm window, you know, a triple pane system or one of the shrink wrap plastic, and reduce the heat loss through the windows, therefore reducing the condensation on that spot because it's not as cold. But you're still getting condensation in the house. There's still other cold spots that are going to be a problem with that much humidity in the house.
Well, I imagine it's happening in the bedroom, so I think that a lot of it is just sort of breathing, you know, like a couple of kids in a bedroom. I mean, it's a fair-sized bedroom, but, you know, it's still... of course, for the bedrooms, there's a recommendation for comfort level of having even humidity units to get, like, to 40%.
Yeah, if you're keeping it at 40%, you're keeping the house too humid, and that's why you're getting the condensation. And once you put moisture in the air, once water evaporates and becomes a water vapor, it moves by vapor pressure and not airflow. So if you put moisture anywhere in any one room, 20 to 30 minutes after you turn off your humidifier, you end up with as much moisture in the attic and in the basement as you did in that room, because that moisture will move through floors, doors, walls, everything except a vapor barrier, which is basically a sheet of plastic.
I understand, but that moisture becomes actual frost. Would you say that that's normal in a double pane window?
If you've got windows do not insulate well, so yes, it's not uncommon to have frost on a frame. I mean, I don't know what temperature you're keeping the room, but if it's icing up, then we may have a little bit of air leakage around there, but we're still have too much moisture in the house.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right. Let's go on to some other folks here. And next, talk with somebody on a cell phone, line 3. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Following up on that question, what should be the humidity in the summertime? 20 in the winter, and what do you say for the summer?
Yeah, usually in the wintertime, depending on the house, you can do, if you get below 20, you start getting a lot of static electricity problems and things like that. Mm-hmm. You get much above 30, and we start ending up with condensation. Now, a lot of it depends with outdoor temperature. The colder it is, the less moisture you need in the house to be relatively high in humidity. If the humidity level outside, you know, when the temperature drops to zero, and we've got 5% humidity out there. If you've got 20% in the house, you're four times what it is outside. You may still get condensation, so it may need to be a little bit lower. In the summertime, since we're worried about mold and mildew and things like that in the summertime, generally I like to see a house no more than about 50 or 55%. Once you get up around 60 or 65, it starts getting a little uncomfortable, and we can start keeping the wood damp enough, we can start getting some mold and mildew.
Okay, and my main question that I'm calling in about is we have a ranch house with electric baseboard heating, and it's about 34 years old, and some of those heaters have been there that long. And there's considerable dust buildup in those little, they're kind of aluminum foil sheets, two-inch row series sheets. And I've been using the vacuum cleaner with a slim nozzle on it, but for vacuuming, and I'm wondering if there's also a need for using it for the other direction on the vacuum to blow it out. It might have a bearing on some allergies, dust allergies in the house, to maybe clean those up thoroughly. Or is there a firm that would do it? And what firm even sells those in the first place that might have information?
Well, as far as cleaning the fins on your baseboard system, yes, vacuuming it out does help. If you can get a light brush in there, that'll work. If nothing else, you could always use an air compressor. If you've got a roofer or something, usually has portable air compressors, they can take an air gun. That does move the dust back around the house, so you do have to vacuum it back up later. But that compressed air is a very good way of cleaning out those little thin spaces that you can't get to with the vacuum cleaner.
And I'm thinking maybe like when they're using an electric saw, the sawdust has a vacuum. Someone has a vacuum to take the sawdust away from the saw.
Those are usually a really low pressure, high volume, and that's not going to do very well at moving.
Okay, so I didn't know whether a second vacuum with one with forced air and the other with negative air.
Probably not. Like I say, you're better off with, say, a small air compressor that can run 120 and blow
and
around.
Dust. Yeah. Dust later.
Yep.
Okay, thank you.
All right, very good. Thank you. To Belgium, line 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. I possibly have spoken to Mr. Speaks before about this, but I found some other information, and I'm getting ready to do this job. I have a roof that is well past being needed to be repaired, and I've done them before myself, so I understand how to set them up and stuff. And they were architectural shingles at that time. But I've been thinking, you know, I'm 60, and I want to live in this house until I die, and I don't want to put another roof on it, so I'm thinking seriously about metal roof, which we have spoken about in the past, and you and your father both have certain opinions on them, but I've looked into the standard pole barn type roofing, which looks just exactly what it talks about. It's not very attractive. I've looked into standard standing seam type roofing, which is much more attractive, and people see those around. Very recently, I've heard about metal interlocking shingles that look like regular shingles or slate or tile or whatever. They have many, many different styles. But I've never heard of anybody using them before. Do you know anything about that particular stuff?
I know of them. I've seen them. They're a little more labor-intensive to install. They're relatively expensive, so therefore from a, you know, a cost per square foot, they're a little bit higher. So we really haven't seen that in this area yet, so I can't say that I've got any experience in it. My biggest concern with any metal roof is ventilation, because the metal does change temperature with outdoor temperature very rapidly, and so we can end up with condensation issues. So you really have to make sure that there's good ventilation and a vapor barrier between the roof area and the living area, or we can end up with condensation on the steel roofing. Which, of course, even if it's got a coating on it, eventually can cause some rusting issues or problems like that. So depending on how the manufacturer's got it installed to provide the ventilation, and making sure that when the manufacturer says this is what we need for ventilation, that that is the bare minimum that you do, that you may even want to add a little bit more.
And that was something else I was going to bring up. When you install the roof, you know, you would have a felt, and then you do your shingles. With a metal roofing, do you have more layers to do on this?
The manufacturers of the steel roofing are combating the condensation issues, and each one has kind of come up with their own little idea of what kind of an underlayment and what kind of prep work. So depending on what you get is what requirements or what suggestions they're going to make for that. And again, we haven't got enough of them in Champaign for me to have a lot of experience on that. I am starting to do some research on it because it is becoming more popular, but I would have to say at this point that I'm probably not the expert on the steel roof that you want to talk to.
Thank you very much.
All right, very good. We have about 7-8 minutes left in this part of Focus. It's our monthly show on home maintenance. Scott Spies is here from the Spies Home Inspection Service. So if you have a question about your home, some problem needs to be solved, give us a call, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And you can send an email to will-talk@illinois.edu. And we'll just keep on going and talk next with someone in Champaign, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'm redoing a bathroom. It's a small bathroom, 5 or 6 by 8 feet. And so I got down and it had some water leak issues. That's why we started this whole project. And there was a fiberglass shower installed some years ago. And apparently it wasn't caulked properly. And so water got in and around and under. And now that that is gone and I can see the wall and the floor, it's pretty much of a mess. The person that was helping me take the fiberglass out left the large sawzall cut right into the drywall, mm-hmm. which is on the outside wall, and it destroyed about a 6-inch corner of it, so I can look out and see the insulation on the outside. It's that pink bat, it looks like. So there is no plastic, no visqueen, or any kind of vapor barrier that I can see that's remaining on that wall, which is, again, it's about 5-6 feet wide where the tub would be. And so looking toward the putting this all back together again, should I repair that piece, replace that piece of drywall that has a nice long, maybe 4-foot cut in it?
Well, I'm going to guess that the drywall is probably what we call a green board, which is a moisture resistant.
No, this was made long, long ago.
Okay.
It's all just plain.
Just plain drywall. You can patch it. The drywall is just a decorative covering. So a little bit of spackle or some drywall mud over the crack should seal it up pretty well. Depending on what you're doing for ventilation in the bathroom, it's always advisable to have a vapor barrier just because that is an outside wall and does get cold and we could have some condensation. But to do that, you may, you know, may involve removing all of the drywall on that wall and stapling up a sheet of plastic over the top of the insulation and putting up a piece of drywall again. Mm-hmm. I don't know how involved you want to get. Okay. Yes, at this point, I would say probably patching the crack, the gap or the gash you've got in the wall would be sufficient, since since it's been this way for, as you say, quite a long time.
It
hasn't really.
The house was built in the '50s.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, you're probably all right with just patching the crack that's there. The system seems to have been working, unless your moisture is actually condensation inside the wall rather than a poor caulking joint. I don't think you need to do too much behind mm-hmm. it.
Well, I think all the damage, there's little water marks and there's a little patch of a little bit of mold growing there, but that was all because the shower was improperly installed and the water got there, but it's all dried up now and we're not going to put a shower there. We're just going to make it a wall and then go from there. But one last thing about this this room is that the floor, when they were making these old houses, they put a little layer of plywood for the subfloor, and then they had this composite glued up kind of, I don't know what you call it. It turns into dust after it gets wet and dries out again. board that they put underneath the linoleum. So when we peeled back the linoleum, there was this vision of crumbly, black, and dusty-looking stuff that I gathered up in pieces and put into a garbage can. And the water, of course, would move through that board sideways and go underneath where there's the next room is a little bedroom with a closet. So probably that whole damage is into and underneath the wall, which is not a load-bearing wall, but if I get over to that wall and find that the bottom of that wall is also kind of dry rotted, do I have to go ahead and cut out that piece of stud wall and put in some new stuff?
Well, I'm not going to say no, but I'm not going to say yes. It's one of those. It kind of depends on what you get into, and that's the fun about remodeling is you really don't know what you get into. It's not a load-bearing wall. It's a partition wall, so it's just separating one room from another. Does it look pretty to have some damaged wood? No. Is it going to affect anything if we leave it? Probably not. So it kind of depends on who's doing it and how thorough a job you want to do with it. Most of the time, that kind of stuff can be covered over and not affect the house whatsoever. Yeah. Now, if it's significant, obviously, or if it's damaged enough that it wants to attract termites or something, that's a different story.
Yeah. But no, it doesn't look like that, but it's... Yeah.
The press board flooring that you're referring to, once it does get wet, it's basically sawdust that's been glued back together, and the glue tends to deteriorate with moisture. And that will need to be cut back to a point where it's solid and put down a new piece of underlayment before you can put a new flooring over it.
Most of the time,
you do not need to go underneath the wall. Unless there's like more than 2 or 3 feet of it underneath the wall, you probably don't need to add some more under the wall.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, very good.
Thank you for calling in.
We'll see how many calls we can get in the time that remains and go to Sycamore, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to call your attention to the humidity issues you brought up a little while ago. My experience is that the humidity gauges or humidistats that are used with, like, humidifiers are grossly underestimate the amount of moisture in the air. I tried reading the humidity in the house with some laboratory quality humidity gauges and was astonished to find that when they were indicating I had 40% humidity in the middle of winter, the humidifier humidistats were indicating that I had like 15%.
Yeah.
And I'm saying, wait a minute here. It sounds like they're trying to sell me a bill of goods, and I'm wondering if you've noticed that, too.
Yes, we have. The biggest problem is that any gauge that you have that is measuring the humidity in the house has to have airflow past it. And once it starts getting a little bit of dust on it, its calibration goes out the window. Therefore, I do like to recommend, if you're going to use a humidifier during the winter, that when you start seeing moisture on the windows, you have it too high in the house and you start going down. That's a better indicator, a better barometer of what the actual humidity level is in the house. Because you're absolutely correct. The longer you have a unit in the house, the more inaccurate that it is.
Okay, thanks very much.
All right, very good. On to Champagne, line three. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I had a question. I have a 35-year-old shake roof that was back in the day when the shake roof, the shingles were much thicker, and they've held up really well, and we've kind of maintained it. But they're getting, obviously, to the end of their lives, and the cost of replacing a shake is out of this world now. I was wondering if you went medieval, if there's any way to, like, I picture just putting pitch on it or some sort of modern tar pitch. It's never leaked. I just wonder if there's any way to do anything like that that kind of seals it and just kind of makes it a little more, maybe getting another 5 years of life out of it.
There are some roof coatings out there that are available. I don't know that environmentally that would be a great way of going over the top of it, spraying tar over the top of a roof. Generally speaking, your wood shake shingle is while it's protecting things, it's not your weather barrier. Usually there is a roofing felt or something underneath there that is actually keeping the water from coming in. The shingles start to deteriorate, and they can expose that felt area or the underlayment, and we can start getting water through it. But the shake is basically there to protect it from extreme weather, you know, the hail and the high winds and things like that. So a shake shingle that looks bad can still end up with being a protective without actually seeing the shingle and seeing how much damage. Usually if you can pinch an inch off the bottom of the shingles, they're starting to get to point where they need to be replaced. Or if they start rotting to where they want to slide down, they want to break in half and slide down, they need replacement. As far as putting something over the top of them to waterproof it, they make some clear materials that will help waterproof the wood shingles, but not necessarily bring them back if they've already rotted or deteriorated. So that's going to be a tough call without seeing the shingle, just what extent they've deteriorated to that you want to try and save them.
They're at their nth degree of, you know, it's time.
Okay.
I'm trying to figure out.
To the best of my knowledge, I don't know of any roofing company that has a coating that goes over the top of wood shingles like what you are indicating.
Okay.
I'm not familiar with one.
And can you run NOS in a Volvo?
Yes, you can.
Okay. All right. Have a great day.
All right. Thank you. Just real quick, if people are having humidity problems in their home and they are not doing anything, they don't think they're doing anything to deliberately introduce humidity. That is, they don't have humidifiers going. What would be other sources of humidity to look for?
The most common one is a damp crawl space, a lack of a vapor barrier in a crawl space. More esoteric things would be a blocked furnace flue. Mm-hmm. The furnace not drafting properly would allow a lot of moisture back into the house. Large fish tanks, things like that people don't necessarily think of as being a moisture source.
And what about if people do not have vents in their bathrooms? I mean, if they're doing a lot of showering, can that make a difference?
That really does not put enough moisture in the house to really bring the humidity level up. Other than in one room, it should dissipate very rapidly, and with the cold temperatures and the low humidity outside, it should go out of the house pretty quick. Directing it against a roof sheathing or something can create a problem, but generally just a bathroom is not going to over-humidify a house.
All right. Scott Spees from the Spees Home Inspection Service. Hey, thanks very much for being here.
All right. Thanks for asking me to come in. The high winds and things like that. So a shake shingle that looks bad can still end up with being a protective without actually seeing the shingle and seeing how much damage. Usually if you can pinch an inch off the bottom of the shingles, they're starting to get to point where they need to be replaced. Or if they start rotting to where they want to slide down, they want to break in half and slide down, they need replacement. As far as putting something over the top of them to waterproof it, they make some clear materials that will help waterproof the wood shingles, but not necessarily bring them back if they've already rotted or deteriorated. So that's going to be a tough call without seeing the shingle, just what extent they've deteriorated to that you want to try and save them.
They're at their nth degree of, you know, it's time.
Okay.
I'm trying to figure out.
To the best of my knowledge, I don't know of any roofing company that has a coating that goes over the top of wood shingles like what you are indicating.
Okay.
I'm not familiar with one.
And can you run NOS in a Volvo?
Yes, you can.
Okay. All right. Have a great day.
All right. Thank you. Just real quick, if people are having humidity problems in their home and they are not doing anything, they don't think they're doing anything to deliberately introduce humidity. That is, they don't have humidifiers going. What would be other sources of humidity to look for?
The most common one is a damp crawl space, a lack of a vapor barrier in a crawl space. More esoteric things would be a blocked furnace flue. The furnace not drafting properly would allow a lot of moisture back into the house. Large fish tanks, things like that people don't necessarily think of as being a moisture source.
And what about if people do not have vents in their bathrooms? I mean, can that make – I mean, if they're doing a lot of showering, can that make a difference?
That really does not put enough moisture in the house to really bring the humidity level up. Other than in one room, it should dissipate very rapidly. And with the cold temperatures and the low humidity outside, it should go out of the house pretty quick. Directing it against a roof sheathing or something can create a problem. But generally, just a bathroom is not going to over-humidify a house.
All right. Scott Spees from the Spees Home Inspection Service. Hey, thanks very much for being here.
All right. Thanks for asking me to come in.
We're going to take a break at this point, as we usually do. When we come back, we'll be talking about computer security, what everybody needs to think about in terms of keeping their computer and their data safe and secure. First, though, we'll take a break, as we usually do, for an update on the market. Stay tuned.
WILL programs are made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, whose MillerCom 2012 lecture series presents Human Social Networks in Real and Evolutionary Times by Hikulis Christakis on Monday, October 17th at 8 p.m. at the Alice Campbell Alumni Center on Lincoln Avenue in Urbana.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the marketplace. Let's go right on out to the futures pits in Kansas City. December wheat trading 712 and three quarters, up 5 1/4. March 729, up 5 1/2. May 736 and a quarter, up 3 1/2. December wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade at 626 is up 3 1/4. March 659 and three quarters, up 3 1/4. May at